So my guest today for Bookmarks is Wellington-based singer-songwriter and musician Vaughan Colgan. He's chosen some great songs to play, and of course we'll talk to about books and movies and podcasts. And Vaughan has a series of shows he's playing around the country with his band. It's a tour that he's marketing in a pretty unique way, which we'll get to. But first, to give you an idea of what he does, we're going to begin Bookmarks with a song by Vaughan. This is a track from his 2011 album Down For It, and the track is called Mental Health Issues in Newtown, Part 2.
Winter comes, winter closes the door, says you're not to go out anymore. Close your eyes, pull the heater up close and high. It's okay. Like all things, it will pass. Though your heart seems to hope it will last. Huddle down, sofa like a cocoon high.
RNZ National, that's the sound of Vaughan Colgan and Mental Health Issues in Newtown, Part 2. Hi there, Vaughan.
Good afternoon, Jesse.
I enjoyed that track, thank you.
Nice.
Reminded me a little bit of Don McGlashan, and maybe I'm just thinking that because I know you've picked a Don McGlashan song, but is he an influence of yours?
Yeah, I mean, he's always been a major influence on my songwriting, although you do try not to sound exactly like your influences, so it's a little bit, you feel a little bit pigeonholed when someone has the perspicacity that you just had to spot the influence.
I do it all the time. I do it all the time, and I'm not always sure it's welcome. But you know, there it is. I just said it, and we are going to play some Don McGlashan, so it was easy to make that connection. That song was released in 2011, and so where are you sort of at on your, or where were you at in your musical journey at that point? When did you first start playing and performing?
Well, I guess I started with music when I was a kid. I mean, I started learning instruments from the age of four. But I didn't actually start writing songs until my late teens. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I was playing in bands in uni. I had one band that released 2.5 EPs in the 90s, which is pretty good for the 90s because you had to go to an actual studio then. And you had to find someone who had this kind of mysterious machine that would burn a CD for you. So, yeah, so that was not bad. But the solo albums kind of started in 99. So, yeah, 2011 when Down For It came out. That would be the difficult, what is it, sixth album? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so by that stage I'd sort of got into a rhythm with the songwriting. I had a band with regular members to play out live with, and so we kind of had our method for recording pretty down pat. I'd record a bunch of songs, take it to the band. The band would sort of develop it so it actually sounded good, and then we'd go back and record the whole thing. So yes, I'd say we were a pretty slick operation by 2011.
And if people are trying to sort of work out where you fit in, there's a couple of other band names that they should know. The Wellington Sea Shanty Society, of which you're a member. And I'm also getting on the RNZ website Gold Medal Famous, which isn't in my notes here, but was that an early sort of iteration of yours?
No, Gold Medal Famous only just went on indefinite hiatus, and that's only because the other members, founding members, moved to Dunedin inconsiderately. Both of those are projects that I've been doing alongside my own songwriting the whole
time. And you performed a bit with Lake South as well, so that's kind of where you're at. And so it sounds like you're kind of into the DIY thing, grew up in Taranaki and had a bit of a band at uni called The Living Room, huh?
That's right, yeah. So The Living Room has, that was the one that recorded 2.5 EPs.
Yeah.
One entitled Chock Full of Fruit and the other one entitled Only the Living Room Can Save You Now.
Chris Knox once reviewed one of your productions, and what did he have to say about you?
So that was the first album, Normal the Normal Normal, which I released in 1999 on the back of the band The Living Room breaking up. So yeah, at that time there wasn't much you could do in the way of sort of publicity, but Real Groove, the record shop. Kids, there used to be a thing called a record shop that sold records.
So we should point out that Real Groove is still around, but yes, point taken.
And they had a magazine called Real Groovy. Kids, there used to be a thing made out of paper called a magazine in which people wrote reviews of things. And so Chris had this amazing cartoon called The Real Pits, featuring a guy called Cess Pitt and a guy called Stu Pitt. And they would have this little back and forth about albums that they liked. And so they very favourably, these two imaginary cartoon characters, very favourably reviewed my first album, which is probably still the high point of my career, getting a good review from Chris Knox's cartoon alter egos.
At some point you did the YouTube album as well. What was the thinking behind that?
So that's called The Winter Sessions. You can find that on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/Vornography, The Winter Sessions. And so what I was looking at my own sort of way of consuming music, which is typically to type something into YouTube and look for a mix. And so there are certain songs where the algorithm on YouTube, if you type in a good song, the algorithm just picks a bunch of awesome songs to follow it. And I was kind of thinking, well, if all I do is listen to lengthy things on YouTube, like, I should make a lengthy thing to put on YouTube because, like, I can't be the only person who's listening to music this way. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the band and I spent the better part of 18 months learning how to play this set of vaguely electronica kind of music from start to finish with no stops in between. So it was a pretty rigorous thing. We sort of came up with the songs. They weren't even songs, they were kind of more grooves first. And then the hardest thing was sort of smoothly transitioning into the next song so that the whole thing would be seamless like a DJ set. So we probably spent about a month writing songs and 17 months working on transitions between songs. And then we went into the studios with Yeah, Mr. Winter Studios, with one day to rehearse and one day to record. We did five takes, and take five was the keeper, so that's what you see on YouTube.
Lovely.
I should add that some of the video comes from other takes because we had cameras that were sort of running out of battery at various times. So if you see a plastic bag appear and disappear on the couch at any point, please don't email me. It's been pointed out before.
Okay, I'm speaking with Vaughan Colgan for Bookmarks. A bit more of his story shortly, but we want to include some of your favourite things as well. So maybe we should play that Don McGlashan song.
Yeah, let's do it.
Why have you chosen this one?
Ooh, this song. This is one of those songs that I sort of think of as fractally perfect. Like, if you're ever have the misfortune to be caught near me in a pub and the song were to come on, I'd probably seize you by the lapels and give you a 3-hour lecture on like how absolutely wonderful the song is from the tiniest details. And it, part of it is that section in the middle where the guy who runs the shop, you know, sort of goes a bit crazy, and he's, you can feel he's like right up in this customer's face saying, look at the way this gun fits the crook of your arm. And he goes on and on about how perfectly formed this thing is. It's also like a great description of the song itself that Don McGlashan has gone and written there. The thing is so well made, there's not a bit of fat on it anywhere. And it causes people, you may notice, like me, to go off on these like just insane rants about how perfectly made it is. And you sort of feel like you can relate to someone when they're doing that about a song, and he's making you think about what it is to be doing that about, you know, a gun and an assault weapon. Yeah, this song was actually written about a mass murder, but it's done from such an oblique angle. He's sort of gone, imagine what it would be like to be the guy who runs the shop that sold that gun.
Yeah.
And
it's coming back to me now.
Yeah, and so you sort of, the main answer is boring. He gets up, he's had a fight with his wife, he drives to work, it's misty. It's most of the stuff about it is boring, but then you can see, you get this little insight into the guy who owns the shop, into his head, and it just makes you question everything about, you know, what keeps a human being stable, you know, what obsessions are healthy obsessions, you know, which ones do we tolerate as a society?
And a great little life moment for Don McGlashan to pick up on and turn into a beautiful pop song.
Yeah, and he's made one of those perfect things, you know, a thing well made about which the song actually, you know, is talking about as well.
Okay. I'm speaking with Vaughan Colgan, that song in just a moment. Just want to share this news flash that has come through. More than 1,000 children and adults who were at a Seventh-day Adventist camp in Rotorua may need to go into quarantine, we're hearing, if they're not immune to measles, after they were exposed to the virus during the school holidays. Health officials are working with the camp organisers and other public health units around the North Island to alert 1,200 campgoers to the risk of measles. So more than 1,000 who are at this Seventh-day Adventist camp in Rotorua may need to go into quarantine if they're not immune to measles. That's news just through. We'll have more online and in the 3 p.m. bulletin. Now here's that Don McGlashan song.
Still warm inside, then go on, have yourself. myself a look, proud of my shot. Almost everything's from overseas. You won't find a better selection. Look at the way this gun fits the crook of your arm. To make a thing like that, you need to know what you were about. You need to know where you were going and go there in a straight line. And everything else you'd have to shut right out. Putting it down and standing back. Can you see the moment when he said, that's it, that's perfect. At a time like that, you wouldn't care about your job or your mortgage or the fire.
RNZ National, it's Mutton Birds and A Thing Well Made. It's the choice of Vaughan Colgan, who's our interviewee today on Bookmarks. We've been talking a bit about your career so far, Vaughan, but you're about to go on tour and it's called The Last Chance to See Tour. Do you want to tell us a bit about that?
So it is called The Last Chance to See Tour because I'm turning a recent diagnosis into a cynical marketing gimmick. So about the start of this year, I was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer. That's the melanoma is the kind of cancer that I have. Stage 4 is the stage where basically you die, although you probably don't know when yet. And so rather than sit around waiting for that to happen, I was sort of trying to think of positive uses for it. And one of the great things about having terminal cancer is it can convince people to come along to your gigs who otherwise may not have. So the basic sort of message behind the series of gigs that we're doing now is, if I can get terminal cancer, you can get a babysitter. Come down.
It's a great slogan.
Come down and see the gig. So it's kind of awkward because there's some amazing medications for melanoma nowadays. Oh, and I'm on one of them. So there is no... The first thing people ask when you tell them that you have terminal cancer is, when are you going to die? Which is a fantastic question to ask on a daily basis. But the answer is that you really don't know. So you're not in a much different position from any other human being, really. Everybody's going to die. Nobody really knows when. Happy afternoon, Radio New Zealand National listeners. So you sort of, we were thinking about it in terms of the band and, like, you know, what we want to do before I pop my clogs and that kind of thing. And so we sort of thought the tour can be a rolling event as long as I'm, you know, fit and well enough to be out there touring. We are on the last chance to see tour, and we sort of had our first show of the tour was in Wellington a couple of weeks ago, 22nd of September, and we proved the efficacy of the marketing gimmick by selling out San Francisco on a Sunday afternoon when they're not even the San Francisco Bathhouse, the venue. So they're not even usually open.
Two things. Yeah. First, I'm really sorry to hear about that. Right. And secondly, you seem to have quite a sense of humour about it, which will surprise many people. How do you, I suppose, explain that?
I guess it would be really hypocritical of me, having made a career, if you listen to the albums, having made a career of making light of some of life's darkest moments and situations. That sort of humour has always been a theme running through the songwriting. So, yeah, it would have been a bit hypocritical to go all emo for my last album and start feeling sorry for myself. And,
I hope you had some emo time. I'm sure it's part of the process.
Yeah, well, I guess that's the, yeah, obviously the times that I spend huddled in a corner of my bedroom and weeping and feeling sorry for myself are very real, but the New Zealand public is not invited to enjoy them. we're trying to keep the public-facing side of it as light as possible.
Yeah. I just got a message on text from a fellow stage 4 cancerer. I love your sense of humour and I relate completely, so that's nice. Are you looking forward to the tour?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean,
do people come along with smiles on their faces and prepared to kind of have a good time, or do you sense about them that they are looking at you like, oh, Vaughan?
Well, we've only had one gig so far to test it out with, and that was definitely just totally joyous, you know. We had about 350 people here. I think that's the capacity of the San Fran Bathhouse, and it was just, from my point of view, just a celebration. So that was really cool. We're already sold out in New Plymouth. That's
great.
That's the next
sort of your home patch, huh?
Yeah. So having a few more whānau in the audience, there might be a few more sort of tears and stuff, but I'll try and tell them enough. Sort of jokes and awful taste that hopefully the thing will be kept light rather than dark.
Yeah, yeah, I guess you are sort of giving people permission to laugh with you if you're the one making the joke, huh?
Totally. Yeah. So we've got T-shirts with my face on them as the merchandise, and the idea was actually for half of the T-shirts to have X's in the eyes. But with due to a thing with the printer, we only had three that actually came out with the X's in the eyes, so they turned into a collector's item at the first gig. And then I had people who had T-shirts with the normal eyes asking for me to sign them, but instead of a signature, I had to X my own eyes out, which was like just a fantastic experience. Like, you're people queuing up to go, like, can you just cross out the eyes on my one? I like those ones better. So, our second run of T-shirts will feature more X'd out eyes, I can promise, T-shirt buyers.
So 1st of November in New Plymouth is sold out. 2nd of November, Lucky Bar in Whanganui.
That's right.
A couple of weeks later, you're at Auckland at Cassette 9, then Playhouse Theatre and Restaurant Mapua, and Dundas in Dunedin. Great to sell them all out, wouldn't it?
Yes, that's true. Come to the gigs, people. This is genuinely the last chance to see tour. I won't be staging another from beyond the grave. Although we should mention that in all our marketing material that we do have a disclaimer saying if a miracle cure for melanoma is discovered, you are not getting your money back.
Yeah, it'd be a special sort of person who turned up your doorstep saying, hey, look, advertising's advertising.
You never know.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about some of your favourite things, Vaughan. Tell me about the Bone People and why you've chosen it.
Mostly because I'm a New Zealand artist cliche. I mean, I felt very cliched choosing it as a book, but then I kept thinking about what would be a more, you know, sort of original choice or whatever, and I just kept coming back to it. There's no.
Yeah, I don't know that that's cliched. I mean, it's probably 30 years old, so there'd be fewer people listening now that have read it or know much about it.
Yeah, and there's just no book in my life that I've reread so many times. And it was the very first book that I picked up when I was really young, and like being able to read grown-up books was kind of a buzz, you know. I picked up this grown-up book and it was just utterly incomprehensible. And then every year or so I'd have another crack at it, you know, like, sure, this can't be unreadable. Like, there must be some way that, you know, look, I'm not going to let this book beat me, you know. And it was probably about six or seven goes that I had at it. And I was probably 15 or 16 when I was, you know, really impressionable as well. You know, when I finally got past that first bit that, you know, doesn't seem to relate to anything. And, you know, it's really, Kerry Hume just dumps you on the deep end of her writing style immediately and makes you deal with it. And that's one of the things I really respect about her, but it made it really hard to start. But also because of that style, I mean, you read and you reread it, and it's just every time you reread it, you find something else. Sometimes I find myself hating it and hating her. And I mean, there's a lot of depression and self-pity and alcoholism, and it's a very precious book as well. It's a book which takes itself very seriously. But then sometimes you'll find yourself reading it just going, ugh. But it's like a, you know, it's like a good friend or a family member, you know. It's just part of you anyway. And when you go back to it again, all's forgiven and you find things in it that you never found before. And like, yeah, I mean, it's one of those books that just contains everything. You know, she's just put absolutely everything into that book. So,
do you as a songwriter get anything out of reading a novel that you really enjoy, anything stylistically?
Yeah, way more from books than from songs, because song lyrics are stupid. But, you know, books have way more time to develop an idea. So, you know, typically the longest song is like 12 minutes, you know. I mean, the shortest book is an hour or 2 hours. So they just have more time to let their ideas breathe and all that kind of thing. And, yeah, so you can pinch ideas and you can pinch whole lines from books, you know, as a songwriter. And it sort of gives you that, it's like a microcosm. You refer to a book and, you know, to someone who knows the book, or, you know, who knows that line, knows what book it's from or whatever. Gives you that whole world as a reference thing, you know. Well, I've never pinched from the Bone People because she has such a unique style of writing that I'd get busted straight away.
You are unafraid to use your own Kiwi accent in your singing. That's maybe something. There's maybe something of the Bone People in that.
Yeah, totally. I think that was that is such a Kiwi book, and it's written in. I think the greatest thing about The Bone People as a book is that it is a real celebration of the Kiwi as artist, and the artist as Kiwi, and it's written in this unmistakably Kiwi tone with unapologetic, you know, bits of te reo just thrown in. You're expected to understand it, you know, grow up, learn a bit of te reo, deal with it kind of thing. And you're expected to understand her flowery style and all her literary references and her just absolutely arcane knowledge. And I think the using the Kiwi accent in song is a little bit the same, although I have to say I'm actually right, and the 99% of New Zealand artists who sing in American or adopted English accents are wrong, and it's glad to be given the chance to say this out loud on a national radio station, because you come from New Zealand. It's so weird.
I sort of went down a YouTube wormhole last night, and was listening to Tex Pistol, The Game of Love, and he was doing the purpose of a man is to, you know.
My golly. And like these people, you know.
Great song, by the way.
You'll be chatting to someone at a gig or something, or someone who you know who was a recording artist, you know. It's like, oh, yeah, really nice to see you the other night. How's it going? Yeah, really good. Sing me a song. Has any man in me? Where's that coming from? And I've heard all of the excuses, and I just don't buy them. You know, people say, that's just how you sing. But that's just how you sing in the Middle Ages wasn't like that, you know. It was more sort of, you know, Gregorian chanting or whatever. You know, that's just how you sing in the Renaissance wasn't like that either, you know. There was much more mannered sort of, you know, choiry kind of style to singing, you know what I mean? So to say that's just how you sing because we happen to have been utterly culturally imperialized by the Americans is, you know, I mean, it's a rubbish excuse. And I had to cultivate the New Zealand accent in song the same as anyone else, because when I grew up listening to Americans on the radio and singing with an American accent, and I'd just sit there in my bedroom and flatten out all my vowels. It wasn't like it came naturally to me anymore. You know, that's what people sort of say about Kiwi accent rappers and Kiwi accent singers. It's like, oh, well, you know, you're just lucky it comes naturally. No, I had to work on that a lot. And I did it because this is where I'm from, and it's so weird to me that you would not put in the effort to sing like you're from where you're from, given that, you know, music and identity have such a strong connection to each other.
I'm speaking to Vaughan Colgan, who's a singer-songwriter, and he's also a music teacher, apparently, because Lee's got in touch and says that you teach her son drums and ukulele, and you're such a great guy and a top musician, and everyone should get along to your show. So that's a good little plug.
Awesome.
We've also already done a podcast review this hour, but you've got a couple of podcasts, or one at least, that you want to mention. Do you listen to podcasts much?
Yeah, I've been totally captured by podcasts. I'm a podcast addict. Probably got about 30 that I listen to on the reg, and I was trying to think of one that wouldn't have, possibly might not have been recommended before, so... this one will definitely not be for everyone, but it's a podcast entitled Overthinking It. And it's a bunch of dudes talking at
it does nothing, by the way, to break the stereotype of podcasts as being like young white men talking about stuff that only white men are into.
They have a Korean-American in there, so it's not just young white dudes. And they're getting quite old as well, so it's, more, it's more just middle-aged dudes. But yeah, it's certainly not for everyone demographically, and it's not for everyone in terms of what they do either. But I think that's why I love it so much, is that they pretty much exclusively watch extremely commercial blockbuster films. They do branch out occasionally into other things, but they tend to do the most commercial blockbuster films. And then they do this breakdown of the film in just the most highfalutin of intellectual terms possible. So it's like these sort of Yale, Harvard educated Ivy League people bringing to bear all of the power of sort of, you know, between them 16 years of education and sort of cultural studies and, you know, various psychology.
What sort of movies, I mean, can you give us some examples of what they've talked about?
I mean, they'll do the latest Avengers movie, you know, or they'll do John Wick 3. Or they'll do whatever. Basically, their rule for ages and ages was to take the number one movie in the country this moment, and that was the rule, was that they'd have to do that. But I think every now and then they'll just do a pop culture property. So if you want to decide immediately whether you like it or not, I can recommend the Hello Kitty episode, which is just about the phenomenon of Hello Kitty, you know, the little sort of Japanese mascot who goes on handbags. Yeah, they've got probably just the single most deep philosophical consideration of what is or isn't a Hello Kitty available on the internet today.
The name of the podcast is Overthinking It, and your film recommendation for Bookmarks, I think you actually heard about this film on the podcast.
Yeah, that's right. True Lies. But it wasn't so much their thing about True Lies, but it was just that one of the major founding tenets of Overthinking It is that you should never let people shame you for liking something. That's one thing. And the other thing is that nothing is too commercial, nothing is too lousy, nothing is too mainstream to have hidden depths or to make you think in interesting and new ways. And so because of that kind of thing, I went on this 90s movie binge, and 90s movies are all just so weird now. Like if you watch them with 2019 eyes, and I think True Lies is probably the most weird example of just,
yeah, I saw that movie
weird.
I don't think it didn't do much for me at the time, but it must be particularly interesting from the sort of the viewpoint of 2019.
Yeah, well, it's got disgusting sexual politics in it. It's got but it's got this level of magical realism that, like, you know, it goes way past sort of Gabriel Garcia Marquez or Isabel Allende or anything like that. Arnold Schwarzenegger in this movie rides a horse through a high-rise building to the top of the high-rise building, and then jumps from one high-rise building to another high-rise building on this horse. You know, and it's like probably for three-quarters of the movie you think the reason it's called True Lies is because that kind of thing keeps happening, and you assume that you're going to find out that none of this was true, you know. But that's absolutely not to spoil a 30-year-old movie, but that's absolutely not what the true lies actually are in the movie True Lies. Actually, all of the improbable and bizarre things that Arnold Schwarzenegger does are just part of the universe of this film, which makes it such a fun sort of a romp. And then his relationship with Jamie Lee Curtis, I can only describe as utterly toxic. It's like something that you would just never have on screen nowadays. So you're sort of, you're watching this like fun spy movie, you know, 1 minute, and then you're sort of wondering why all of these impossible things are so easily possible in the universe of this movie. And then every now and then you're just sort of recoiling from the screen going, oh, was that even okay in 1990 whatever when that came out? Because it's definitely not okay now. So it's recommended for people with a strong stomach for watching things they don't necessarily agree with. But also for anyone who likes seeing someone clinging to a missile, which is on the side of a jet, which has gone out of control, but still being safe at the end of that little adventure.
Okay, that's True Lies, Vaughan Colgan's been talking about. He has been our guest on Bookmarks, picking a few of his favourite things, and Vaughan is partway through the Last Chance to See Vaughan tour. He's got stage 4 cancer, he's dying, and he is on the road and performing, and I encourage you to go and see him. If you can, New Plymouth sold out, but he's got a few other dates around New Zealand. And Vaughan, you're going to pick the music for the end and the origins of this song. The Southern Cross, a pub some people will know in Wellington.
Yeah, so shout out to the Southern Cross quiz crew. That's something I do on a Thursday night, is run the music quiz at the Southern Cross. And last year, we sort of developed this tradition at the end where if you were a particularly low-scoring team, you'd have the option to choose the exit music.
Great innovation.
So low-scoring teams were often new teams who didn't realise that the song we're about to play is always one of the choices. And so it would always be "I've Had the Time of My Life" by Bill Medley and Jennifer Warnes.
From the Dirty Dancing
movie. The Dirty Dancing movie. Or it would be something else. And quite often people would just pick that one, to the groans of the assembled, you know, masses who'd heard it last week and the week before or the week before that, totally unaware that that was what was happening.
It was meant to be a punishment, but it's grown on you.
Yeah, and it sort of grew on everyone over that time. And so I remember my memory of this thing is seeing it in the movie Dirty Dancing and being so angry that everyone's dancing to it. Because it's got synthesizers and stuff that are totally 80s, and the movie's set in the 50s. Mm. And I was just screaming at the screen going,
yeah,
you can't be...
fit. Yeah, doesn't fit the rest of the soundtrack, does
I
it?
I hate you song. But then after this, having this year where slowly, you know, and you saw how much joy it gave people. Quite often I'd pick like a cool song, like Heroin by Lou Reed or something like that, you know. And if anyone ever actually played it, I'd be like sort of vaguely disappointed that I wasn't listening to Time of My Life instead. So, yeah, and just seeing the effect that it can have on a room full of people and the joy that it can spread. And I'll admit it, you know, over the year of probably playing it, not every single week, but playing it more weeks than I didn't play it, it's seeped in and it's turned into a song that I kind of like.
Great, and it has a certain poignancy too, given what else we've been discussing over the last half hour. Mm-hmm. Vaughan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Vaughan Colgan, catch him on tour, and this is Time of My Life.
Now I had the time of my life. No, I never felt like this before. Yes, I swear it's a truth, and I owe it all to you.
'Cause I had the time of my life, and I owe.
So long now, I finally found someone to stand by me.
We saw the writing on the wall as we felt this magical fantasy.
Now with passion in our eyes, there's no way we could disguise it secretly. So we take each other's hand, 'cause we seem to understand. Just remember,
you're the one thing
I can't get enough of.
So I'll tell you something.
sorry we didn't make it all the way to the saxophone solo. It's a deep regret of mine.